KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, in today for Mina Kim. Forum turned 30 this year, and we threw a special birthday event on Tuesday night at SF Jazz Center. Coming up, we'll bring you some highlights from that show, which featured Michael Krasny's interview with author Salman Rushdie on his new book, The Golden House, and a performance by musicians Zakir Hussain and Joshua Redman. You're hearing them now, performing St. Thomas by Sonny Rollins. Join us next, right after this. Welcome to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro. On Tuesday night, Forum held a special 30th anniversary celebration at SF Jazz Center. We're going to bring you some highlights from that event, which focused on the arts and featured an interview with author Salman Rushdie. And of course, Michael Krasny, who has hosted Forum for nearly 25 years, talked with Friday host Mina Kim about the show's history. We started with a montage of Forum's coverage of some of the biggest news stories over the years.
And good morning, I'm Michael Krasny. Because of the tragedy at 101 California in San Francisco yesterday, we are going to open this morning's Forum program talking about that event.
Is the dot-com revolution over, or are we just seeing an ongoing Darwinian shakeout?
Around 9 a.m. yesterday, in one of the most devastating attacks ever mounted against the United States, terrorists crashed two hijacked airplanes into the New York City World Trade Center and one into the...
Last night, soon after the 48-hour ultimatum issued by President Bush to Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein and his two sons had passed, the United States began military action against Iraq with a limited targeted cruise missile attack. With San Francisco's mayor, Gavin Newsom, deciding to sanction with licenses in San Francisco hundreds of gay and lesbian marriages, we discussed the legal and... Can New Orleans be rebuilt in the wake of all the devastating and extraordinary destruction to that once vibrant city? Coming up on Forum this morning, we discuss yesterday's elections in depth with analysis in the opening hour about the landmark victory of Barack Obama.
Gas line explosion and fire has devastated a San Bruno neighborhood. Four people are confirmed dead, numerous other injuries.
And the right-hander for the Giants throws. Swing and a miss! And that's it!
There is joy today in San Francisco and throughout the Bay Area and Northern California. The San Francisco Giants, after a 52-year wait, were at last victorious in a World Series. Osama bin Laden is dead. The news that the Al-Qaeda... Skyrocketing rents, stratospheric home prices. Housing costs in the Bay Area are among the highest in the country, and there is little relief in sight.
It's official. Donald Trump has been elected as the nation's 45th president, stunning pundits and pollsters and sparking disbelief and shock around the world.
On Friday night, an electronic music concert in a 10,000-square-foot building in Oakland's Fruitvale District, known as Ghost Ship, turned into a deadly inferno, with a death toll reaching... It was one of
within a few minutes of that, we heard the scream, someone screamed fire, and people started exiting the building.
And in this hour of Forum, we look at the uptick in activity by far-right or white supremacist groups, how San Francisco and other cities are preparing for future rallies, and how Bay Area activists, civil rights groups, and others are responding.
Gosh, Michael, what was it like hearing those tape cuts from the last 30 years?
It's a little bit sobering, to tell you the truth, Mina. It has a strange effect on me because, you know, there's so much bad news, unfortunately. I often think of Bertolt Brecht, the German playwright, who said, the man who laughs has not yet been told the terrible news, but I don't want to go too much into that sort of vein this evening. This is a celebrative feeling, and we're going to be as upbeat as we can be.
Yes, all those things, but also what this makes me think about is how much the show has evolved over the years. It started out with just local politics, right?
It started out pretty much with local politics, yeah, and there were, Contra Costa water rates and things of that sort. I had left commercial radio, and as Dan Shore put it so appropriately, found my way into the promised land of public broadcasting. And that was 5 years after Forum began. But I said, let's do state, national, and international. Let's just do news and also the arts. And it became very expansive and, if I dare put it as such, capacious. We wanted to really cover as much as we could.
Yes, though it feels like these days national news really does dominate what we're looking at in a lot of ways.
That's one of the things that's occurred, certainly, especially, you know, sometimes I think people ask me all the time to describe the Trump administration and what's changed, and a good Yiddish word comes to mind, spilkes. You know, you can't sit still. It's almost as if, you know, news is happening constantly.
I know. How many times do you get that phone call at like 6 p.m. after you've prepared for the show, and they're like, we're changing the topic.
That's right. Or guess what he tweeted this morning.
Yes, exactly. We're changing the topic.
Well, we've done that many times, and it's a credit again to our team that we're able to do that and do it with what we hope sounds to all of you smooth and without terrible kinds of difficulties.
I remember reading a quote of yours where you said something along the lines of, if it were up to you, you'd only talk with novelists and politicians.
Well, that goes back.
But aren't you so glad that you expanded it to the extent that you did with all the memorable moments you've had?
Yeah, and I mean, we've been very fortunate. You know, I was reflecting on some of our work, though, and thinking about the fact that people always want to know about the famous people and the illustrious people and, you know, the people who are larger than life, almost mythic in some ways, because we do have that great privilege and good fortune of interviewing.
See from the images that...
Well, but then some of the most memorable moments, and I know this is true for you because it certainly is for me, are moments that... you have poignancy on the air, somebody telling a story, a personal story often, that is extraordinarily moving. And I think maybe you ought to tell about Jennifer Rodriguez.
Oh, yeah. Jennifer, so there so far have only been two times where I got choked up on the air. And one of them was with Jennifer Rodriguez, who is the executive director of the Youth Law Center. And she was a foster youth, and she had been in multiple group homes. She... I believe was homeless for a while. She was a woman, a child through the foster system that had experienced a lot of trauma and a lot of need. I think she may have had some violent outbursts. It was just a very difficult experience for her. And yet she said that what would have meant the world to her was if someone had known what she wanted. I'm getting a little choked up. Just think about it. What she wanted for her birthday or for Christmas.
Just paid attention to her, really.
Yes. Right? Yeah. And this is a clip, I believe, that our producers pulled of her describing that moment.
Growing up feeling like nobody sees anything that's a light in you as a child, that all they see are sort of the cracks in your being, and that people don't know anything about you, let alone remember when your birthday is or how old you are, so what kind of gift you might want. It's Christmas. It actually makes you feel like you're a non-person. I know when in most of the group homes I was in, we were called residents, and we weren't even referred to by our names. And that was how I felt. I felt as if I was just basically a commodity, a, you know, sort of a person to fill a bed, as opposed to a kid that was special and important.
I remember that moment because as she was starting to describe it, her voice started shaking. You could hear a little bit of that, and she had tears starting to well up in her eyes, and so I could feel the same response. But it is sort of an amazing thing, isn't it, when you're having a conversation with someone and they say something so unexpected, but that also just speaks to something so deeply in you, and you feel like you're the only two people in the room.
I was just struck by that story, though, about Jennifer Rodriguez, because I think what we do, and what I'm very proud of, and you know, it goes well beyond just talking to writers or politicians, is have people tell their stories. Yeah. And they're not only new stories, but they're stories that can actually have impact on people's lives.
Yes.
And that's where I think we can take some no small modicum of pride.
One of the things I wondered about was the interview guest or guests that were most meaningful to you. And I know you've mentioned John Updike a couple of times.
And that was a very meaningful interview because it was his last interview and he had cancer. And it's interesting, you know, to find out that people like John Updike or Nora Ephron, when I interviewed them, had cancer and knew it but were quiet about it and were suffering and were on book tours despite what they were going through. I mean, it's almost heroic in some ways. Some would think maybe foolish, you know, they should be... attending to themselves, but you know, I think we have a cut, actually, don't we?
We do.
If I have the right cut in my mind, where I asked him kind of a cliche question about the death of the novel, but V.S. Naipaul, the great Indian writer,
right,
who, and Salman Rushdie will be on stage soon, when you all know about the fatwa that was put out on Salman Rushdie by the Ayatollah Khomeini, when V.S. Naipaul got off an airplane, somebody ran up to him and said, did you hear about Rushdie? There's a death threat against him from the Ayatollah Khomeini because of the book, The Satanic Verses. And Naipaul without missing a beat said, this is one of the most severe forms of literary criticism I've ever heard of. But Naipaul was talking about the death of the novel, and I think that's the lead into
this. Yes, you had asked him to react to what V.S. Naipaul
which they've been talking about for a couple of generations.
Well, let's hear it.
I feel for me in my what's left of my life, writing life, that it's still the best way to tell the truth. No expression of your actual opinion or your actual thoughts excites the variety and the richness of trying to invent a fictional situation and move it along. It brought news in England, the 19th century, 18th century. It brought news of how the upper classes or upper middle classes behaved. It was truly a useful civilizing tool, and to some extent, I think it does still bring us news and is a civilizing tool. It acquaints us with other lives, lives we're not going to live, and to that extent, I don't think its demise is quite upon us.
And that so nicely and succinctly describes what a lot of his work is all about.
Yes.
And, you know, we have the good fortune to have Salman Rushdie with us tonight, who also writes out of that sense of almost chronicling a time and a period and bringing it into a vivid kind of spectroscopic view. There are those people that you meet, and this I used to say, you know, work in talk radio long enough and you meet all your idols, or you meet all the people that you, not entirely, but to a great extent that's certainly been true over the over 30 years I've been in broadcasting, and it's just our good fortune and our privilege to have that.
Well, Michael, I want to just thank you for this show that you've built. I mean, you really have built.
Thank you. Thank you. Well, now, how would you like to hear some music? We have some great musicians here. I mean, world-class musicians tonight. In fact, let me give a plug. September 17th here at SF Jazz, Zakir Hussain and Josh Redman will be playing together in an East meets West kind of phenomenon, because Josh grew up in Berkeley, as many of you know, and Zakir, who's lived here in the Bay Area for many years now, grew up in India. And they play very different instruments, but they make splendid music together. Welcome, Josh Redman and Zakir Hussain, playing Punjab.
Thank you. Zakir Hussain and Joshua Redman are performing at SF Jazz Center Sunday at 3 and 7 p.m. At this point in the show, novelist Salman Rushdie came to the stage. Michael has interviewed Rushdie many times over the past 30 years for his books, including The Satanic Verses and the Booker Prize-winning Midnight's Children. Michael talked with Rushdie about his new novel, The Golden House, which spans the election of Barack Obama to the rise of a havoc-wreaking figure called the Joker.
You just keep turning novels out one after the other.
Well, I mean, you know, what else would I do?
Act?
Well, if, you know, nobody makes me an offer. I mean, if actually, the one thing I'm really sad about is that some years ago, I was unable to accept an invitation because I was on book tour to take part in what was then called Untitled Will Ferrell NASCAR Movie. And their idea was to find the three most improbable people they could think of to be dressed up as NASCAR drivers, you know. Like with the helmet. And it was just one shot. It was like slow walking towards the camera, slow motion, you know, Top Gun, Take My Breath Away music, you know. And the three people they wanted were Julian Schnabel, Lou Reed, and me. And we all wanted to do it, but just the scheduling didn't work out, and in the end they dropped the idea.
So, what a shame. What this culture has lost.
I feel, you know, you can keep your novels.
Well, you do love popular culture, and that comes across again.
Yeah, one of the things about this book is that it finally allowed me to talk about movies.
Yes.
You know, because the narrator of this novel is this young man who's I think of him as just out of NYU film school and trying to begin to be a filmmaker.
He wants to make a movie of the Golden Family, who are at the center of the novel.
There's this bizarre family, very mysterious Indian family, this old patriarch and his three adult sons who relocate to New York. They change their names. They conceal their pasts. They don't want to talk about where they came from. And they're obviously hiding something pretty serious. And this young man thinks that could be something I could do a movie about.
Yeah.
So he kind of inveigles himself into their lives in order to find out about them. But the great thing is that having a filmmaker as my narrator allowed me to use like a lifetime of film nerdery. You
know? Yeah, and script, and film script.
And pour it into the novel.
Yeah.
You know, so that was fun because, I mean, you know, if you come from Bombay, which I still call Bombay, if you come from there, then that's a city obsessed with movies, obsessed with movies. And if you grow up there, then they're in your blood. You know, there's no way of not being a movie addict. And then, you know, when I was at college in England, it was this extraordinary golden age of the sound cinema, you know, and it's very hard to explain to young people now what it was like when what we now think of as the great classics were this week's new movie, you know, that you would go to the movies and it would be Fellini's 8 and a Half, you know, and next week it would be Ingmar Bergman's The Seventh Seal.
I mean, so how many people remember the Surf Theater here in San Francisco?
Yeah.
I mean, that's it was all.
Well, it was exactly that. Yeah. There was this little theater in Cambridge when I was at college called the Arts Cinema, tiny, much, much smaller than this room that we're in. And I felt that I got my education in that room, mm-hmm. you know? I mean, as much as I did in any library. I would go and see movies two or three times consecutively to try and understand them. You know,
especially Bergman and Fellini and Buñuel.
Well,
was the trio.
Anna yeah. René, you know, last year at Marienbad, an almost impossible film to understand. Yes. So I went to see it in three consecutive performances in order to try and work it out.
Yeah.
And I mean, I loved movies, you know, and have done ever since. And
can we include Bollywood in that?
Yeah. So, well, you know, up to a point. I mean, you know, everybody, no matter how serious a reader you are, sometimes you want to read trash. And so no matter how serious a film goer you are, sometimes trash is good.
Yes.
We're listening to highlights of Form's special 30th anniversary celebration at SF Jazz on Tuesday. We'll be right back after a quick break. Welcome back to Form. I'm Rachel Miro. Today, we're listening to highlights of Forum's special 30th anniversary celebration at SF Jazz Center on Tuesday. Now we'll return to Michael's onstage interview with Salman Rushdie about the arts. And in a bit, we'll hear a panel discussion with all our guests at Tuesday's show about the role of arts in today's world.
I think, really, I have a very broad church view of the arts. I think I don't only have a kind of let's have the Olympian heights, you know. I think it's fine. There is a real reason for commercial fiction that people can take to the beach and read over a weekend and so on, and it gives them pleasure and so on. Fine. I'm not against that. But I think there's another kind of writing which people like me try to do, which will endure. You try to write to outlast yourself, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, my friend Martin Amis has this lovely phrase where he says, what you hope to leave behind is a shelf of books. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to be able to say, like, from here to here, it's me. You know, and now this is number 18. So it's not like Philip Roth. And it's not like Joyce Keller Oates. Which is but it's, you know, it's not
nothing. It's considerable.
It's not nothing.
It's something to be very proud of. Although I remember an interview we had years ago when you said to me, does the world really need another book? How many writers ask themselves that question?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, this is what I say to students. I say, there are enough books. Mm-hmm. You know, that if all of us stopped writing tomorrow forever, there would be too many great books for any of us to read in a lifetime.
Sure.
You know, so there are enough books. So if you're going to add a book to that mountain, it better be something necessary that you can't avoid writing. It better be something you have to say. You know?
Well, let's talk about what you have to say in the Golden House some more, and we'll move off of film for the moment, because I wanted to I was struck by so many important motifs in this book that have been associated with you: migration, American identity, identity in general, but American identity comes into focus here. You laser in on. It's a book about New York, a certain part of New York. But it's also a book that has almost, especially since you sort of bring this character in who can't help but be identified with Trump, to the times we're in right now.
Yeah.
It's current in that sense. And it makes me, as a reader, think a bit apocalyptically with all these hurricanes going on, with all the things in the world, with Brexit, Modi in India, you know, Trump here in the United States. I don't mean to conflate all these things, but you know, suddenly I'm reading in your book, and there I see the lines from William Butler Yeats of The Second Coming, and I'm thinking, are we there?
Yeah, what rough beast. It's our come round at last.
Yeah, slouching toward Bethlehem.
Slouching towards Washington to be born.
Yeah, right.
I don't indulge in despair. You know, it seems to me despair is a kind of, it is an indulgence. The thing to do is to defeat the enemy, you know, and we face some real enemies right now, and we have, so.
Walt Kelly, remember Pogo? We face the enemy, and it's us.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a thing that I always loved, the poem of Cavafy, Waiting for the Barbarians,
yes,
which is set at, you know, like the end of the Roman Empire, and they're waiting for the barbarians.
At the gates.
And at a certain point, it becomes clear that they are the barbarians they're right. waiting for.
Yeah.
You know, that there isn't going to be any barbarian invasions. The barbarians are already here. You know, there's a point at which the narrator in the novel, you know, René, this young idealistic guy, is despairing of his own country and his own generation, and he's much younger than me. He's a kid, you know. And saying, you know, who are we? Mm-hmm. Who are we that we have let this happen? You know, and I think that's the interesting question, not who is Donald Trump, because that's easy. He's an asshole. I've met him three times, and I can confirm to you.
Well, let's talk about that, because I think you met him once, and he pointed his finger at you and said, "You the man," or something to that effect.
Yeah, I mean, isn't it embarrassing? I was at the opera. I was at the Met in New York, and I was just walking down a corridor, and he was coming the other way. And as he came past me, he extended his extremely long index fingers. And he said, "You're the man." And I literally looked behind me. I thought, you know. But there was nobody behind me, so apparently I was the man. And I have no idea why I was the man. I think it meant I have no idea who you are, but I feel I should say something nice. You know, so, and then I met him again sort of around this time of year, the U.S. Tennis Open was on. And he asked me if I like tennis, and I said, "Yeah, I do, and I sometimes go, you know." And he very kindly offered me the use of his box, which I thought was nice, but I thought if I were to accept, this would be a career-ending move. And he didn't just offer me his box, I have to say. He, in a way that has become too familiar to us, he told me how it was the best box. No, you have to really try my box, because my box is like better than all the boxes.
So you don't despair over Trump?
You know, I mean, I think nothing is forever, and I think that there are indications that we see the administration fall apart every day. We see the relationship between the administration and the Republican Party fall apart also. And if the Democrats could just get their act together, you know. The strange thing happened with my book and me, which is that on election day, when I voted, I was optimistic and hopeful and so on, and thought it would go the other way, and it didn't. My book, which I was writing at the time, knew what was going to happen.
Yeah. You know? Excuse me. Thus, we have the figure of the Joker. Yeah, but also of Nero to some extent.
But it's very strange.
Both of your main characters.
How sometimes the art can be smarter than the artist.
Yeah.
You know, and somehow the book knew what was going to happen. Mm-hmm. You know, because one, you know, the book is like two things. On the one hand, it's this attempt to write a kind of ultra contemporary story about the exact moment in which the book is being written, mm-hmm. which is the thing you're not supposed to do.
Right.
You know, but it's kind of exciting. You know, I love. There's this phrase in one of the, I can't remember which of Hemingway's bullfighting things. But one of them, where he says the great bullfighter works closest to the bull. Mm. You know, that if the bull is like over there, that's not so difficult. But when he describes the fights of the great bullfighter, like the bull is literally grazing the bullfighter's thigh, you know, and so that's incredibly dangerous. You could get gored, yeah. You could get killed. But I felt like that coming up against the present moment is a bit like that. It's working close to the bull.
I have a little theory about that, which we'll have to discuss at another time, because I think sometimes novelists get in touch with forces even of presentiment or of the future that they're not even aware of. Blake believed in this. It's not only novelists, obviously, it's poets like Blake, but that there's something about art. Maybe we can talk about that later when we have everybody else on stage here, but it's always a great pleasure to talk
wonderful,
to you.
Wonderful, Michael. Thank you.
The whole idea of tonight was to celebrate the arts, and talk about the arts and bring the arts into focus, even though it's just a piece of what Forum does. But we do have a little Forum arts montage, and let's bring it up. Academy Award-winning director and Academy Award nominee, Robert Redford.
Toni Morrison, our guest this hour. Great pleasure to have you on our program this morning. Thanks for being with
us. This is lovely. Thank you.
Jane Fonda, Spike Lee, Dallas Walker, Joan Rivers.
Back in business, an aided grand.
Well, those, of course, are the distinctive and dulcet sounds of the inimitable Eartha Kitt.
Thank you very much.
Sarah Silverman, welcome to Forum.
Hi.
One of this nation's most distinguished literary figures, John Updike's novels have won Pulitzer Prizes, the National Book Award. I've waited a long time for this. I'm delighted to have you here. Welcome.
Delighted to be here.
Like they've never gone away, come Ascension Day.
Elvis Costello performing live.
Retired boxer Mike Tyson is with us, promising to talk about everything, and that's what he does in his one-man show. Mike Tyson, Undisputed Truth.
How you doing, Mr. Krabs?
I'm doing okay. Good
Craster. I'm with the Craster.
He is with the Craster. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
Carlos Santana joins us in studio for this Forum Hour.
Sweet Judy Blois, it's so good to meet you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. The gypsy rover came over the hill. That one.
Through the valley shady.
Yeah. Whistled and he sang till the greenwood rang. And he won the heart of a lady.
It's the first time I've ever sang publicly. It'll be the last, probably. But you can join us a number of ways. You can call us now at our toll-free number, whether you're listening on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. The number to call, 866-733-6786.
Hey, Kraft.
And you can join us live.
You're a pretty mellow guy. You know what I mean? Like Charlie Rose type of guy. I thought you'd be a more Howard Stern guy. Talk about when I came to my wife's house.
Where did you get that impression?
Come on, I came to my wife's house. Let's talk about when I came to my wife's house.
Okay, did the listeners hear you singing along with yourself there?
After an evening of conversation and music, Michael was joined on stage by all of the night's guests, Salman Rushdie, musicians Zakir Hussain and Joshua Redman, and performer and theater director Rodessa Jones, founder of the Medea Project, Theater for Incarcerated Women. They discussed the role of artists in today's world.
So now we thought we would extend the conversation somewhat and talk about the role of the arts today, and who better to talk about this with than these four folks who are up here with me. I'd just like to maybe begin by saying, let's go back to Trump for a moment. I mean, and the reason I do that is simply because, you know, there's a lot of concern among artists about freedom and about questions of the arts being supported, you know, the nonprofits especially at this time. With a turn to the right, making any judgments here, just saying that people feel maybe we're in a different kind of incubator now or a different kind of time in general. But you can all express your art really freely. In fact, Salman, I was reading something you were saying about, and this gets into an issue we've taken up on the Forum program repeatedly because it's such a big issue out here, how when you were in Europe, they had rules against Holocaust denial, for example. They had rules against hate speech and toxic speech. Here, it's free speech. Yeah. And free speech in some ways feels better for the artist in many ways, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. And I mean, I think, here's what I think about the person that we have to call the president. That I don't want, for the next 4 years, all of us just to tell Trump stories. Mm-hmm. Because they're already boring. You know, and I think the business we're all in, you know, the business of art is the creation of beauty. That's what it's about. And through the creation of beauty, the creation of meaning, you know, and that's what we have to do. We have to do our job. Our job is to create art, not to fight with a politician. That might be some part of what we do, but it can't be the thing that we do. You know, I mean, the thing that we do is what we've always done. You know, these wonderful musicians, making their music is what they do. And that's what we want them to do, you know. And I think what people who write books have to do is to just write the best books they can. It's just, do the work. Because otherwise, yes, it's true that the arts are under attack. It's true. You know, but if the artists aren't making the art, there's nothing to defend. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Well said. And Rodessa, I know you want in it because when someone talks about art being beauty, truth is beauty, beauty is truth. I never thought I'd be quoting Keats here tonight, but, you know, that's all you need to know, according to John Keats. But you have always looked at art from, does it serve a social and political purpose? And that's kind of different from the art as art's sake or art as beauty, isn't it?
But I think I find it that art for art's sake used to have a place, but as we look at this world and old age and Orange is over there, we should be making work that we communicate with each other. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in art that saves lives. I loved just feeling the two of you playing. It was so exuberant. And I'm an old dancer, and improvisation is the ultimate art. You know, to get a musician and a mover, and you don't know each other, you haven't really talked about it, and you go for it. You know, and the audience feels it too. Back to your question, Michael, I just think that it's really about, I agree with you, it's about we have to continue to do our work. We have to the work will call upon something deeper from us, you know. Even like looking at Facebook, a year ago I was like really impassioned about responding to, is he a good president, blah, blah, blah. And then I realized that all the other beautiful stuff, the Buddhistic thoughts that was coming through, quotes from everybody, from Bob Marley to Gandhi, to, you know, it was just like this other stuff was kind of floating to the top that people were sharing, even on Facebook, as we're trying to like hold ourselves up and be buoyant and practice beauty. And beauty is not always this, beauty can be horrific, but it is still blazing, and it burns through things and creates new spaces for us to live and be. Yes.
I wanted to say about... Yeah.
Thank you.
I wanted to say about improvisation, which you know, in the world of music and jazz, and actually also in, you know, what you and your father did, you know, along with sitarists, to create a kind of conversation between the sitar and the tabla, you know, which you both have done so extraordinarily, your father before you and you after him. I've found that as I've got older, I've become more willing to use techniques of improvisation in my work. You know, I mean, I used to, when I was young, I needed architecture, you know, and I needed to have that before I could do anything. Now I'm actually much more willing to sit down and just let it go and see what happens on the page, and then do I like it or do I not? So this kind of jazz, you know, is becoming more... I've begun to feel more comfortable with it, you know, and I like it more, which is I love listening to jazz, I love listening to improvised art, you know, and I'm trying to find out a little bit more about how to do it.
Does that like music to your ears, each of you, hearing him talk about improvisational art as being, you know, something that could lift us just as easily?
Yes. I mean,
trying to do, isn't it, with your instruments?
I'm just trying to hang in there, man. For dear life. Yes, I will say that I probably would only be doing this if I could improvise. And the reason why is because earlier in your conversation, Mr. Rushdie, you were talking about how, you know, so many great novels have already been written, more than anyone could read. And so if you're going to add something to that, it better be good, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that if I had that sort of pressure, that weight on my shoulders every time I stepped up to play, I would never be able to play. I mean, improvisation kind of lets you off the hook, you know? It allows you to toss that question to the side.
I'm struck by what you're saying, because when you talk about I'm just trying to get along, for example. It's, you know, like, okay, make a living. You're a musician. You got to make a living.
I didn't mean that kind of
thing. No, I understand. Yeah. But there's a story that you probably know, everybody up here probably knows, by James Baldwin called Sonny's Blues, which is a remarkable story. And it's as if he has to play the brother, and it's about two brothers, but the brother who's the jazz musician, the blues musician, has to play a certain kind of music to reach people. And he's going more and more, he's taking more and more chances, which is what you were talking about. Mm-hmm. He's getting more and more imperiled as he goes out farther. He uses the metaphor, of course, of going out into the water even farther and farther and so forth. But that's blues music. That's not necessarily, I mean, what you were doing was exuberant kind of music, but you're still creating
blues is exuberant music, too.
Yes. Blues, you know, blues is
a very affirmative music. It's affirmation in the face of adversity. And
it takes you in dangerous places, though. It can. That's what I meant.
Well, I want to go dangerous places, for sure. The more dangerous, the better.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, we all want to take a leap of faith, you know, jump off the mountain without a parachute and see if the currents bring us gently down to
beautiful
meadows.
Would someone say about the bull getting closer to goring you?
Yeah, but I mean, music, it's kind of hard for me to... somebody asked me a question, so, you know, you play music, which is very spiritual. and you know, it's connected to the deities, the gods and goddesses, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, is that what it is? And I just sit and I thought about it, and then I said, wait a minute. How can I ask 1,000 people sitting in an auditorium to close their eyes, take deep breaths, and say Om, and concentrate on my music? They have, you know, paid immense amount of money to come and sit in a concert hall to have a good time, to be entertained, to enjoy the music. And in that process, maybe traverse through certain areas which are enlightening, which are something that opens the eyes to other possibilities. But those are not forced attempts to make that happen. They have to happen spontaneously and by themselves. So this is, you know, one thing you talk about, my music is meditative, my music is spiritual, my music is this and all that. But at the same time, you also take a hell of a lot of money to go out and sit down in a concert hall and play a concert. Mm-hmm. So, and at the same time, you talk about saying something radical through your music, but at the same time, you are out there because those people have come to be entertained, to have fun, to enjoy themselves.
So it's like, I remember the old definition of literature by Horace, we go back to the Romans, to teach and entertain. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's that simple. That's what maybe great art is all about, teaching and entertaining.
Edutainment, as KRS-One calls it.
Edutainment.
To entertain and to educate.
I think this idea of my music can be dangerous, you know, dangerous in the bad way. I think, yes, I mean, we have a very, very, we're very invested in our music, and it's a part of our identity, and we have a big stake in it. But for me, when I'm up there on the bandstand, it's our music, you know? It's the other musicians you're playing with, and it's the audience, too. Mm. It's a collective undertaking.
You are listening to Forum. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information on how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Rachel Miro. We're listening to highlights from Forum's special 30th anniversary celebration at SF Jazz on Tuesday. Here's just a small sample of some of the politicians and other notable figures we've interviewed over the years.
We're talking, by the way, with First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton.
Welcome, Senator Bernie Sanders, and thank you for being here.
And it's great to be with you.
Barack Obama joins us here this morning on Forum. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning.
We're spending the hour with Jimmy Carter, the 39th President of the United States. Former United States Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. Welcome, Grover Norquist. Good to have you aboard.
Good to be with you.
Sonia Sotomayor.
Newt Gingrich.
Patrick Buchanan.
Well, thank you very much, Michael.
And Willie L. Brown was elected mayor of the city of San Francisco on Tuesday. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Frank Jordan is the mayor of the city and county of San Francisco.
Mayor Gavin Newsom.
Nice to see you. Good morning.
San Francisco Mayor Ed Lee.
Governor Jerry Brown. Governor, good to have you with us.
Yeah, great. Good morning.
Thank you, our audience, for listening over the years. And now we'll close with another song from Zakir Hussain and Joshua Redman, the Sonny Rollins tune, St. Thomas.
You've been listening to a special broadcast of Forum's 30th anniversary celebration at SF Jazz. Guests included author Salman Rushdie, musicians Zakir Hussain and Joshua Redman, and performer and theater director Rodessa Jones, founder of the Medea Project, theater for incarcerated women. And here's what's coming up Monday on Forum. At 9, NBC News reporter Katie Turr joins us in the studio. She's the author of Unbelievable, My Front Row Seat to the Craziest Campaign in American History. And at 10 a.m., Forum's guest will be Stanford business professor Robert Sutton. He's got a new book on how to deal with people who treat you like dirt. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producers are Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our interns are Anna Sterla and Patrick Fitzgerald. Our managing editor is Ethan Lindsay, and our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I'm Rachel Miro.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.